The Custodians Beyond Abduction by Dolores Cannon. When I first began to work in regressive hypnosis and past life therapy in 1979, I never imagined the unusual places and situations that road would take me. Over the ensuing years, it has taken me into some strange byways. I have had some incredible adventures, met some fascinating people from the shadowland of the past, and retrieved valuable information that was thought to have been lost forever. It was brought to the light of day by the incredible practice of regressive hypnosis techniques. My time was devoted exclusively to exploring the past, and writing books about my discoveries. My insatiable curiosity, my ravenous desire for research, and the craving for knowledge swept me up and carried me along on a constant search. I was not concerned with hypnosis as applied to present-day situations, unless it could be used to solve a person's problems in life, problems which arose from phobias or health problems caused by the effects of a past life, or karmic connections that carried over and were affecting present-day family relationships. I only used the standard form of hypnosis, which deals with the understanding and control of habits, smoking and overeating, etc., if it was one, incorporated with past life regression. The technique I developed automatically put the subject into a past life situation. Thus, I did not concentrate on their present life. All of this changed when I was inadvertently introduced to the phenomenon of UFO abduction experiences. My adventures took a totally different and unexpected direction. Doors opened and I was allowed glimpses of a world that others thought should be left shrouded in the murky darkness of the unknown. Some say it is better not to probe into things that our human mind is probably incapable of understanding. But if knowledge and understanding are there, I knew I would have to search and ask my inexhaustible questions. Any new avenue of research always presents a challenge to me, and it is a challenge that I cannot ignore. But my entry into this field of research deviated from my normal course and would require altering my technique and adapting to new circumstances. I have always had an interest in UFOs, so-called flying saucers. I have read much of the literature dealing with the phenomenon, and was most impressed by the Betty and Barney Hill case when it was first introduced in the 1960s. The Interrupted Journey. This was the first so-called abduction case. There were many things in that report that convinced me that the Hills had a true experience. For example, the apparent telepathic communication and the non-hostile intent of the aliens seemed to me perfectly plausible. I also read what the critics had to say about the strange events in our skies that would not quietly disappear. After weighing the pros and the cons, I was privately convinced there was something real occurring that could not be explained by the rational, logical thinking of the skeptics. Maybe the entire subject was never intended to be logical and simply explained. Maybe the aliens' tactics were intended to do the very thing they ended up doing, making man wonder and consider the impossible. Even as a teenager in the late 1940s and early 1950s, when the first flying saucer accounts were made public, and were met generally by public ridicule, I kept thinking there might be something to it. Over the years I maintained a passive interest by a change of direction, 3, reading and keeping up on the latest developments. But I never once thought I would be taking an active part in the research, and end up communicating directly with aliens from another sphere of existence. Maybe my years of work in the bazaar had carefully prepared me for the eventual encounter, because when it happened I was not astonished, disbelieving or frightened. I was curious. This has become my trademark, curiosity, and it was to serve me well when it came to extracting information. I was introduced to the area of UFO research and investigation in May 1985. My friend, Mildred Higgins, invited me to attend a state meeting with members of MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, to be held at her home in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Mildred was assistant director for the state of Arkansas. She knew about my interest in the strange and unusual, and thought I might like to meet some of the investigators and other interested people. Even though it was not in my field of hypnotic past life regression, I thought it would be interesting to ask questions about some of the UFO cases I had read about. At the meeting, I learned that MUFON is the largest and most respected of UFO investigative organizations and has members worldwide. Since I suspected most of the people at the meeting would be scientifically oriented, I thought it best not to mention my work. It was still considered by many to be in the realm of the absurd, and I take my research too seriously to open myself up to ridicule. At that time, my work was carried on in private and few knew what I was exploring. Walt Andrus, the international director of MUFON, was present, and I found him to be a talkative and demonstrative man who seemingly had the facts of any UFO case filed in his memory for instant recall. I was impressed by his knowledge of the cases, many of which he had personally investigated. Another man, who was to have a profound effect upon my future connection with UFOs, was not impressive upon first meeting. Lucius Farish was so quiet the average person would not have noticed him. He listened intently and seemed to be absorbing information like a sponge. I now know that he learns more this way than by being in the center stage. He publishes the 4, The Custodians, monthly UFO news clipping service, and has all the latest UFO information from all over the world instantly at his fingertips. Before this meeting was over, I had become more comfortable with the people there, and disclosed that I was a hypnotist working in the realm of past life research. I expected them to dismiss me, because this was definitely not what would be considered a scientific approach. But to my surprise, Walt said hypnosis could be a valuable tool, and any tool that helped to disclose information would surely be welcomed. After the meeting, I set up communication with Lucius Farish. He was supportive of my work and did not ridicule, as I had feared. A year passed before my first encounter with the realm of UFO hypnotic research. About the time this happened, Whitley Strieber's book Communion burst upon the scene. Bud Hopkins' book Missing Time had been out for a while, but I was too involved with my own work to read either of these. By coincidence, in May 1986, my agent gave me a copy of Strieber's book and suggested that I read it, since it contained accounts of hypnotic regression concerning UFOs. At the same time, Lucius, or Lou, as he is known to friends, called to tell me there would be another annual meeting at the Higgins House in Fayetteville. He had been contacted by a woman who thought she had been abducted by aliens and wanted to have a hypnotic regression. He wanted to know if I would conduct it. Although I had no experience in this realm, he thought I could handle it. After all, it was rare to find anyone who had had experience with this type of thing, especially in Arkansas. He said most psychiatrists and psychologists did not want to handle it, because it was outside their field of expertise. Merely knowing how to conduct hypnosis was not enough of a qualification. You had to feel comfortable working with the unusual, so you would not be disturbed by whatever came forth, and be able to conduct an objective investigation. I certainly fit that qualification, at least. I had worked for so long in the field of the bizarre and paranormal that I did not think I would find anything that would surprise me. If I could handle a man dying at the explosion of an atomic bomb a soul remembers Hiroshima, or the actual observation of the a change of direction, 5, crucifixion of Christ, Jesus and the essence, I should be more prepared than most investigators to handle the abduction of human beings by aliens from outer space. At the meeting there were about 30 people present, and I worried about this being the proper atmosphere in which to conduct a regression of this type. It was certainly not the relaxed setting so conducive to successful hypnosis. In my work, I usually go to the home of the subject, and the session is conducted in absolute privacy. At times there may be witnesses present, but this is always with the consent of the subject. Often they are people the subject requests to be there, and these are normally few in number. The atmosphere is extremely important in order to put the person at ease. I told Lou this would be like putting the girl on exhibit in a goldfish bowl. I didn't know how she would react to so many people being present, and I thought the audience would surely affect any results. I was also secretly worrying, because this type of case was outside my normal practice. I wasn't sure how to proceed. My methods automatically propel the subject backward into a past life. I would have to modify and change my working habits to keep her from going into the past, and concentrate on events in this lifetime. Since I have used many variations of my technique, I knew I could find a method that would work. I would just have to change my procedure, and I didn't know the effects or the results it would have. My other methods are thoroughly predictable, although there will always be a rare individual who refuses to follow the pattern. In such cases, the operator must learn to adapt their technique to fit. In this case, there would be no time to practice or work out new method. It would have to be done by trial and error, playing it by ear. With a room full of people observing, the conditions were not really conducive to experimentation. Thus, when I conducted the session with the young woman, it was done with apprehension, not because of the subject matter, but because of the changing of my faithful working pattern. I was again moving into an unknown area where the results were uncertain, for many reasons. 6. The custodians. Amazingly, the diversion in my technique worked very effectively, and we obtained a great deal of information. Those present did not know this was my first time to attempt this type of case, because the session proceeded so smoothly. For me, it was a landmark case that opened the door to UFO investigation. It was my first introduction to little gray beings who removed people from their homes at night, tests performed on board spacecraft, star maps, and encounters tracing back to childhood. It was also my first exposure to the fear and trauma felt by the subject. These feelings were so prevalent that the emotion blocked the obtaining of information. The young woman could only report what she saw and heard. She could not find answers to the many questions I asked. All of this only aroused my interest and curiosity. I knew I could develop a method to bypass the emotional state, and allow the subconscious to supply the answers. This method had worked in other cases, because the subconscious contains all the information. I saw no reason why it couldn't also work here, once I devised a method. I was already working in the strange and the bizarre, because the contact with Nostradamus occurred during this same year, 1986. This eventually resulted in the writing of the trilogy, Conversations with Nostradamus, over the next 3 years. Thus, strange and unusual events and uncharted territory did not frighten me. It only awakened my reporter's curiosity and desire to know more. It was after midnight when I left the meeting to return home. I didn't relish the idea of driving home on my deserted country highway at that time of night after this type of experience. All the new and strange information came flooding back into my mind. I felt very leery, and cautiously looked at the sky repeatedly during the lonely drive. Did this regression mean there really were beings out there having contact with humans? What if they knew I had just done this session? Maybe they were watching me at that very moment. The thoughts created a very uneasy journey. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning when I pulled into my driveway with much relief. I knew I wanted to explore this field further, but I also knew I would have to come, a change of direction, 7, to terms with my own, very human feelings about beings from space dealing with humans. Naturally, it aroused fear in me. We have been preconditioned through years of watching horror movies featuring strange and terrifying aliens intent on taking over the world. These creatures had always been presented as a threat, not as helpers. How could I keep these feelings from being transferred to the person I was working with? I was well aware that when a subject is in hypnotic trance, they are much more acutely aware of everything, including the mindset of the hypnotist. This case opened the door to work with other cases of similar types. It was the typical abduction scenario that has been repeated so often it has now become commonplace. As I worked, I saw a pattern emerging. And when this pattern occurred repeatedly, I soon knew whether I was working on a genuine case or a fantasy. The subject always saw the little gray beings with large eyes, and various types of medical tests were performed. Occasionally, another more human type was seen in the room during the testing. Often, strange insect type of beings were observed. There were always the curved room, the table, the bright light positioned over the table, and the use of unrecognizable instruments. Often there were computer-type machines somewhere in the room. And many times the person was shown a star map, or a book before they left the craft. They were always told they would understand and remember the book when the time was right. Many cases had their first contact in childhood. The age of 10 seemed to be a crucial time period. I even found a few cases reaching back through 3 generations. The mother and grandmother of the subject reluctantly reported similar visitations and events. This gave me the impression of a laboratory experiment where several generations are studied and monitored over a long period of time. During this time I was working with Phil and receiving the information that became my book, Keepers of the Garden. Some of the pieces were beginning to fit. That book discussed the ancient astronaut theory of the seeding of the planet Earth by aliens from outer space. I learned they had been watching us, 8, the custodians, since the beginning of life on Earth. What could be more natural than that the aliens were still monitoring us and watching our development? To me, this was the reason for the tests and examinations, but it had to be done covertly so the person's life would not be affected. In Keepers of the Garden, I was told that the ideal situation would be that the person retain no memory whatsoever and continue their normal routine. But I was finding cases of people remembering traumatic and painful events, and often remembering them through dreams more than consciously. I was told that the chemicals and pollutants in our atmosphere, the drugs, medications, and alcohol in the person's body could affect the chemistry of their brain. This would cause them to remember bits, pieces and snatches of the experience, but they remembered in a distorted fashion colored by emotions. They were not remembering the actual event. Their conscious mind was changing the event into an emotionally charged memory. My job would be to get past the conscious emotions and talk directly to the subconscious, as I had in my other work, because I knew from experience the answers were concealed there. With the emotional conscious mind influence removed, the truth of the event could surface. Why? Many investigators study only sightings and physical traces such as landings, and stop there. Other investigators study only abductions and stop there. I started with these and have moved beyond. I have discovered glimpses of a much bigger picture that is only now beginning to surface, a picture which our human minds can barely comprehend. It could be the biggest picture ever shown to humanity, the story of who we are, where we came from, and where we are going. Are we ready to learn the secrets of the story of ourselves? It has been generally agreed upon by several writers and researchers into this UFO phenomenon that the aliens appear to be involved in some type of genetic manipulation, with or without a change of direction, 9, our consent. It also appears they are not acting totally out of a selfish clinical motive, but are carrying out the orders of a higher authority. Much like the personnel of a hospital often appear impersonal as they perform their various tests and examinations. How many times have we met with the same indifference when we wanted to know the reason for hospital tests? When our children exhibited this same fear and curiosity, we hushed them by saying the doctor needs to know something, they wouldn't understand, just to be quiet and do as the doctor says, and it won't hurt at all. Even if we know the reason for the tests, we do not take the time to explain it to the child, because we think it would only create fear, and they wouldn't understand anyway. So we try to keep the child quiet until the necessary work is done. Then we often hear, "But, Mommy, you told me it wouldn't hurt, and it did." This creates the feeling of mistrust as though they have been lied to. In some cases this creates a fear of the doctor, nurse or hospital. Maybe we also misjudge the child, taking it for granted he will not have the mental capacity to understand, when actually this may not be so. The aliens display the same attitude, as though they are dealing with a child or someone of substandard intelligence who wouldn't understand even if it were explained to them. The abductee reacts the same way as our children do, by saying the aliens have no right to treat them in this manner. They say the aliens do not respect them, and do not bother explaining what is truly going on. If these examinations and tests are occurring at a large rate involving many, many people, I see it as being comparable to the coldness and aloofness associated with a crowded hospital that administers several hundred identical tests each day. After a while these tests become so routine and mundane they feel no need to explain. There is not enough time and not enough interest in trying to communicate with each individual. Then when an occasional worker does take the time to comfort and console, their kindness is remembered and stands out among the apparent disregard of the machine-like workers. I believe the attitude of the aliens therefore is not necessary disregard for us as a separate. 10. The custodians, personality, but may be the same clinical attitude of overwork and being swamped by routine. Many researchers have also struggled with the reasons behind the tests and examinations. Several different ideas and explanations have been brought forth, and several more will come forth in the future. Each person involved in this unusual field will formulate their own theories of what is occurring, based on their own research, and also based upon their life experiences, mindset, and expectations. Many think gene manipulation or engineering is occurring, with various goals in mind. Some think ours is a superior race that has almost reached its perfection, and the aliens may be from an imperfect or dying race. Maybe they somehow have lost the ability to reproduce themselves and therefore need our species' sperm and ova to help perpetuate their own dying race. They hope to accomplish this by interbreeding, if not physically then clinically, and producing human-alien hybrids. The idea is viewed with horror by human beings, and thus we consider anyone with this goal in mind to be also horrible. My theories are different. I do not believe they are doing this for their purposes, but for ours. Of course, we have seen that there are several different types of entities involved, and there could be some negative types doing these things for their own gains. But I believe these are in the minority. The renegades or mavericks of the UFO groups. As I explained in my book, Keepers of the Garden, there is a higher power at work directing a plan that was fashioned for our world eons before the first human appeared upon our planet. This master plan was conceived and worked out by methods far beyond our comprehension. The beings were assigned the carrying out of various steps in this project. Each was responsible for its own small part, and really had nothing to say over the completion of the whole project. The entire scope was probably even beyond their comprehension. As they produced life on our planet, nurtured it and pruned it over eons of time, it was only a job, an assignment. They may have had similar assignments on various other planets at various stages of its growth. As individual beings, a change of direction, 11, died off their work was continued by others. This was a project of extremely long range, and one orchestrated in meticulous detail. Time did not matter, only the final goal, the creation of a species of superior physical and mental accomplishments. Such a project could not be accomplished overnight, and there was always the possibility of even such a carefully laid plan going wrong. It would have been impossible to anticipate every possible circumstance. The fly in the ointment occurred when a meteor crashed into the Earth and introduced organisms that were foreign to our planet. In their own environment they had been harmless. But when introduced into the pristine atmosphere of Earth they multiplied and mutated into a volatile threat to the seedling human race. This created the introduction of disease into the human body. The ideal plan had been to create a perfect, disease-free functioning body with a long lifespan. There was much sorrow when this unforeseen development was discovered, and a meeting was held on the highest level of the council to decide what to do. There was much sadness and remorse because the grand experiment had gone awry. But it was decided that since so much work had already been done, it would be better not to throw out the entire experiment. It was decided to try to minimize the damage that had been done, and proceed by making concessions and moving forward with what they had left to work with. In the early days as the human developed, there was constant care, pruning, and manipulating of the species. Gene manipulation and engineering have been a part of our species since the very beginning. It is not something new. That is why we are here at all, and not living in a cave and scratching out a living in the wilderness. The aliens have carefully bred and influenced the development of our brains, gradually introducing the amazing psychic powers and intuitive feelings that are common among them. As man developed away from the animalistic stage and became capable of handling his own life and affairs, the aliens were not allowed to have as much influence. It has been emphasized that this is the planet of free will, and it is. 12. The Custodians, a strict universal law that free will must be respected. The task of Gardener changed to custodian. Man was given many devices and knowledge to make his life easier, and then the new species had to go on their own. If they made mistakes and misused the knowledge, that was their right to do so, as long as they did not infringe upon the rights of others outside their own planet. The aliens were under strict laws not to interfere. Of course, the studying of the species continued. The experiment had to be checked from time to time to see how it was developing and adjusting to its environment. Corrections were made at the appropriate times through gene manipulation. If this has been occurring since the beginning of time, why can't it still be occurring?